honor for me to present to you Daniel Lee from Benton, Arkansas.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm Daniel and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Daniel! Love you, Daniel! Lots and lots and lots! Oh,
wow. Thank you. I love it. Alright, let's see here. We can just do this for an hour. Maybe not. All right. I'll start off. My home group is the East Side group of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I'm talking about. Benton, Arkansas. We're otherwise known as the Benton Mafia because if you leave, you die. And my sobriety date is August 8th of 98, and for that I'm extremely grateful. And if you're a little burnt like I am, or maybe got a real short attention span like I do, that's probably the most important thing I'll say all night. And so, yeah, let's have a dance. Let's go, man. Let's go. Thanks a lot. But that's real important to me. And I hope everyone here has a sobriety date, because there's two things. You know, the first thing is I never, ever want to forget what it was like on that day, August 8th, you know, or I stand a chance of going back there. And and the other thing is, you know, the fact that I hadn't had a drink or any mind-altering substances since that day proves to me this program works. It proves it to me. And it also proves to me there is a loving God that cares about me, you know, and that's a huge deal. Oh, man, I'd like to thank the committee. Thanks a whole bunch. I got to say, I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this convention with all my heart. But, you know, they asked me to speak, and I was like, why me, you know? It's like, we got this saying at my home group, this tradition, you don't ask a home group member to speak at the home group because they've already heard all your bullshit. And but, you know, after thinking about praying about it and everything, you know, it's God's writing a script. I ain't writing a script. So I'm here, and if there's any newcomers who never seen me, never heard me, maybe I can say something. And would you please raise your hand, and we'll go out on the porch and have this meeting. Damn it. I'll put it in order. All right. Like I said, I'm a little burnt. I was real burnt when I got here. Alcohol and some drugs really messed my brain up. But I've always talked real slow my whole life, so I'm not going to say very much. But, you know, I'll probably talk for like 3 or 4 hours or so. But I do have a clock. Okay. But anyway, just try to bear with me. Maybe we can get a Hick interpreter around here or something. But So I'm supposed to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, what I'm like now. All right. So who all was there for the tree cutting incident the very first thing this morning? Okay. So y'all know I put the damn chain on the chainsaw backwards. All right. Now this is not the first time I've done something ass backwards. And as a matter of fact, my mother and father's here. She can attest to that. I was born ass first, literally. I was a breech baby. Of course, I don't remember it, but you can talk to Mom. She'll fill you in on the details. But I literally, the ass came out first, and I've been ass backwards ever since. You know, I had the little, kind of messed my legs up or whatever. Had to wear the little Forrest Gump braces. I don't remember it, you know, for a little while, a year or so. But I turned out all right, didn't I? Yeah. Okay. First things I can remember from my childhood is being pissed off at my sister. I got an older sister, and she's like the bossier type sister. And, like, we live out in the country, and there's no neighborhood pack of kids. That, you know, there, it was just me and her. And so when it was playtime, you know, we had to play what she wanted to play, by God. And so I ended up having to play, like, all this girly crap, like Tea Party and restaurant. And I would have much rather just been out in the yard digging a hole or, you know, whatever other little boys do. But I started getting resentments early on. But the main thing about my childhood that sticks out to me, and then I'll move on, is I had a whole lot of anxiety as a child. I had this knot in my gut from grade school on, you know, and I don't know if other normal kids have any of that. I know I had it bad. It was so bad that, Mom and Dad, I keep referring to Mom and Dad. Hell, Mom and Dad's here, half my damn home group, all these people, you know, people could tell my story better than I could and a lot faster that are in this room. So if y'all get sick of listening to my ass, just, like, knock me over the cliff and we'll get one of them. But anyways, where the fuck was it? Okay, man, I almost let something slip there. But got to watch out because we know somebody's going to listen to this on tape in the morning that couldn't be here. I would just like to say for Mark and Robert that I am dressed in a suit and tie at behind the podium. Please picture that in your brain. But anyways, sorry you couldn't be. Okay. The anxiety was so bad, the knot in my gut. By like fourth or fifth grade, I actually went to the doctor, I believe, over this. And, you know, nobody knew, you know, just give this boy a fifth of Jim Beam, it straightened right up, you know. But anyways, you know, and I felt different than and apart from like every other A speaker you'll ever hear. So anyways, that was childhood. I rocked along. I want to skip a bunch of the drunk log tonight because I want to talk about the cool stuff, which is sobriety. But I got to talk about something here first. This would be like, you know, I may share a few opinions tonight and just like take what you want, leave the rest, whatever. But I did some things in my drinking career that were drugs, okay? We didn't call them outside issues back then. And when I got sober, I went to a lot of speaker meetings, and I heard this term, and I did outside issues. I grew outside issues. I ran them up my nose, up my veins. I smoked these outside issues. I put them in different orifices and these outside issues, and I was like, what the hell are they, man, if I would have known what that shit was, man, I would have done that, you know, why didn't anybody tell me, and like I said, I was really burnt, so if there's any newcomers here tonight that are having problems with, I don't know if I'm the only person that had problems with stuff like that, but let me just clear it up, it's code, outside issue equals drugs, okay, so I don't feel the need to say outside issue. Actually, drugs is a shorter word, so we'll get done faster. But anyways, you know, an outside issue to me, I get real confused about that because it's like outside issue. I think like issue, like slavery or abortion or like whatever, politics or religion. You know, and I'm like an issue. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that. Let's move on. My first drunk, okay, I had done a lot of drugs before my first drunk, but my first drunk, I got to talk about that. And let me just say, after talking about outside issues and drugs and all that I respect this podium. I respect Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will identify myself as a real alcoholic, you know, because that's what this is about. So anyways, damn, it got me out. I might be going to need some more of that. Yeah, that's Ozarka. All right, the first drunk, me and a buddy had a fifth of Jim Beam And I'd never drank whiskey before. I'd had beer a few times, but never enough where I could drink all I wanted, you know. And we had this fifth of Jim Beam, and we started drinking it just straight, no chaser. And after about the fourth or fifth big gulp, this feeling came over me, you know. And it was just this perfect buzz. And I mean, and the thing was, the big thing was, I no longer had that knot in my gut. I didn't care. You know, I just started high school at the time. Everybody messed with me because I went to high school, Catholic high school for boys in Little Rock, and I'm from like way out in the country in Saline County, and like everybody messed with, even my teachers, you know, messed with, you know, because of the way I talk and stuff. And I'm like, look, y'all live in Arkansas too, you know, shit. But anyways, When I drank that first time, I didn't care about any of that. Who cares what these people think? And I felt okay in my own skin for the very first time that I can remember. You know, now I had some really happy times as a child, and I probably was all right in my own skin as a child. But this is the first time I could remember in a long time. And what I realized today, as I like to call it, I reached the perfect level of being messed up, all right? And hopefully y'all know what I'm talking about. I had reached the perfect level where everything is perfect. I got the perfect buzz. I got no worries. You know, I'm okay with myself. I'm okay with my buddy and what we're doing. And it was perfect. And so what did I do? My brain says, if this is perfect, just think about what one more drink would do. So I drank the rest of the bottle, blacked out, ran around screaming like an idiot out in the woods, did a bunch of stupid stuff and didn't remember any of it. Came to the next morning thinking, you know, I don't know what happened last night, but it sure was good. And that just set the stage for my drinking career. That's how I drank. So, like I said, I'm not going to tell a bunch of stories. There's a lot of weird stories I could tell you about, you know, being tracked across Lake Washita by a beer can trail and getting busted on some shit and smoking cigarettes hog-tied and county jail, but we can talk about that after the meeting. But just let me tell you about what my daily routine was the last few years or whatever, my drinking. I would come to in the morning and run to the window to see if my truck was outside wherever I came to, because I didn't remember. A lot of times I didn't even know where I was, but I'd see if my truck was there. A lot of times it wasn't, you know, And I was a serious blackout drinker. I'm talking about at least 90% of the time I drank, I blacked out, because it was just insane, the phenomenon of craving and the physical allergy. I mean, it was not only could I not stop once I started, it was like I had to drink it as fast as I could for some reason. But anyway, so I would find my truck, figure out what day it is, do I need to be at work, you know, find if I got any alcohol left or any drugs to get my head right for the day. You got to get started off right, you know. And I would spend the whole day getting high, doing things, going to work, and trying to figure out what I did the night before. And then thinking to myself, and this is every single day, okay, and thinking to myself, why did I get so messed up last night? Because I didn't plan on getting that messed up. And tonight, maybe I won't get that messed up. Maybe I won't get messed up at all tonight. You know, like it'd be good to take a night off, you know. So that's what I'd be thinking. And I was working construction, and I'd get off work. Everybody I worked with drank. My boss drank. Somebody always had a couple of ice cold beers, you know, and they'd give me these beers. And you got to drink them, you know, because you deserve it. You put in a hard day. I was toting sheetrock, stocking sheetrock, if anybody's ever done that. It's some lots of fun. But anyways, you deserve it because you worked hard. So I'd drink these couple of beers, all right, and get them in me. And then I that plan I'd made earlier in the day about not drinking tonight would just go out the window, and I'd start making new plans. Like, okay, here's the deal. Okay, I lived in a dry county. You had to drive about 20 minutes to the liquor store. So I'm going to go up to the liquor store, get me a 12-pack, and just, you know, chill out, smoke some pot, drink a 12-pack. Because I had a very large tolerance for alcohol, and a 12-pack was just enough to take the edge off, You know, it didn't get me drunk. And I was going to mellow out tonight. Not going to go to jail, not going to wreck anything, not going to embarrass myself. And that'd be my plan, you know. And I loved the speaker last night, Danielle, talking about the delusion. That's what it is. I believed a lie. I believed the lie that I could drink and get to that perfect level and stop. And then just maybe drink enough after I got to the perfect level to maintain that perfect level forever. You know, that was like my plan. And it never worked out. I had to start over every day, you know. But that was the whole goal of my life, was to get to the perfect level and stay there. But it was like I get to the perfect level and just like fly around past it every day. But so anyways, I get in the truck and head to the liquor store. And I live in Benton, all right. A lot of y'all are familiar with that area. I get to about Bryant, my brain be telling me, you know, you might as well get a case of beer, because that way you won't have to come back tomorrow. You know, and I get up about Alexander, about to take the exit, and I'll be thinking, you know, they got these 30 packs now. You know, what if one of my buddies wants a beer? You know, I don't want to be a butthole, you know. And I always came out of the liquor store with a bunch of beer and a big jug of whiskey, because that's what I really liked. And this is going to last me like 3 or 4 days. And if y'all drank like me, you know what happened. You know, that phenomenon of craving kicked in, and it was just impossible for me to stop. You know, unless I got locked up, passed out, got knocked out, which that never even happened. That happened. I got kind of whooped up on a little bit a few times, but I've only been knocked out one time in my life. I fell off a house about 5 years ago. Anyway, I'm real hard-headed. That's the deal. You know, I was born ass first with a real hard head. So that was my routine. And it was every day. And so you can imagine the problems this created. I'm not going to go into detail. You know, problems with the family, problems with work. You know, even though it was a drink and drug-friendly workplace, you know, it got crazy. And I just couldn't hold it together. So what happened was, let's see, it was summer of 98. You know, I had a lot of problems like every alcoholic. And what happened was alcohol quit working. And hopefully y'all know what I mean. But, you know, what I mean by that for me is I had all these issues going on in my brain. These were issues. These were like things you think about and talk, you know, issues. And, look at what I'm doing to my family, you know. Look at all my buddies dying. I had a lot of acquaintances die in a real short period of time. Look at all this screwed up shit going around me. And why am I even here? And this is all the kind of stuff you start thinking about as an alcoholic. And what do? You go drink. Because you've got to have that sense of ease and comfort so you don't have to think about that crap. And so that's what I would do, but I couldn't get no ease and comfort anymore. And I would drink insane amounts of alcohol trying to get that sense of ease and comfort. And the best I could get was slobbering drunk and pass out. And it got so bad that I've done the deal. I've gotten drunk 2 or 3 times in a day. I've spent 2 days trying to drink and pass out. You know, it got so bad I got suicidal, but I didn't have the guts to blow my brains out. Thank God. I tried to get some people pissed off enough to kill me. I'm really serious about that. So my best thinking was, this is what I'll do. I'll just drink myself to death, okay? Because I know you can do that. I'd known people that had done that. So, I set out to do that. And I came to on August 8th of 98. After a 3-day blackout, they turned me loose from jail this one day, went on a 3-day blackout. August 8th of 98, I came to, my parents' house was destroyed. I destroyed it in these fits of rage, because there at the end, when the alcohol quit working, see, I'd always been a happy-go-lucky drunk, but when it quit working, it was just nonstop rage. Or the other extreme, like I'm terrified. So I'm either like running out into the bushes, which I did, because they're after me. Or I would start stuff with people I shouldn't be starting stuff with, you know, just because they look at me weird. Anyways, I came to on August 8th of 98, and I realized that I can't, three or four of them, man. I've always had a powerful thirst, okay. I realized I can't even die. I mean, I cannot even die. And I remember I walked outside of the house, and I looked up at the sky. It was a beautiful blue sky, real early in the morning. And I said, God, if you're real and really help people, then just let me die on the way to this gas station or give me some kind of help. I had to go and get some cigarettes because I couldn't find any in the house when there were some right there on the coffee table. But I couldn't find them. But I said, God, just please let me die on the way to this gas station, which is like 5 minutes away, or give me some kind of help. And what happened was I got arrested at the gas station like 10 minutes later. To this day, don't understand on what grounds they charged me with what they charged me with, but that's not relevant. We won't go into that. It's Saline County, you know. But anyways, moving right along. But I went to jail, and it was really, really a bad time, okay? I was not in a good jail goer there at the end. The last week I drank, I went to jail twice, right? Those two times, while I went to jail and while I was in jail, I was hogtied at least 10 times. I'm talking about they would come into the solitary cell to hogtie me. And I'm like, what can I do in here? Beat my brain on the wall or something? Y'all would like that, wouldn't you? I was not a peaceable jailgoer, but there at the end. But anyways, we weren't on good terms. I would say that. And they really wanted me to help them get some people that I was really good friends with, and I was having no part of that. And they played a lot of tricks with my brain. And anyway, this went on for a long time, and it was really, really, really bad. And I've done a lot of inventory work over this resentment I had towards them. But what happened was, after a day or a day and a half, I don't know, but see, I've been drinking large amounts of alcohol, okay? You know, better than a liter of whiskey every day for months, probably better than a half gallon for a couple of weeks. And when they locked me up that day, I stopped, you know, cold turkey, and I got real sick, started having convulsions, had some seizures, and went unconscious. I had a sponsor a few years ago that gave me a new term for it, the crappie flop. I can relate to that. I don't see him in here. He was here last night, but I can relate to doing some crappie flopping, but hogtied. Okay. Anyway. Okay. So I went unconscious for I don't know how long. Could have been a minute, could have been hours, a day or something. But when I came to, I was in this fog. You know, I didn't know where I was. And I was having these weird hallucinations. Like, I've done things that make you see things before, those drugs, you know. This was like nothing I'd ever experienced. This was like some evil stuff. Anyways, there was a trustee. Like I said, I was in my home away from home, the solitary cell. But this trustee looked through the little square window on the door at me and said, and I seen him, and I was like, man, where am I? Because I need to get out of here. And he told me, man, you died, and you're in hell now, and you're never getting out. And I believed that man. All right. And yeah, it's kind of humorous. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I still can't laugh a lot about that, but that's good for me. I'm glad y'all enjoy it. But I honestly, I'm not kidding. I really honestly believe that. And then I was like, hold on, you know, I've been wanting to die, but this ain't so cool, you know. And That's where I hit my bottom, because a few days before that, I'd had a moment of clarity. You know, like 3 or 4 days before that, when I'd been in that solitary cell, I'd had this moment of clarity that I am screwed, okay? I've tried everything I can to manage my life, and I cannot make it. And if there is a God, he's going to have to help me, because nobody can help me. I knew that no human power could help me. They'd tried. They could lock me up. Just one example, okay? I smoked 2 cigarettes hogtied one. I'll tell you the whole story if you want to hear it after me. But, I mean, they can't help, you know, and I cannot help myself. If there is a God, he's got to help me. But I didn't ask him for help then. I waited until I come out of that blackout on August 8th. And here I've finally broke down and asked God that everybody told me my whole life loves me and cares about me and is there to help me. And now I'm dead and I'm in hell and I'm screwed for all eternity. And, okay, so that's the circumstances of my bottom. But what the bottom really was a feeling of 100% hopelessness, okay? And that's what I share with each and every one of y'all. You know, because we all got crazy stories about how we get here. I've never heard anybody tell the same story that I've got, and that's no big deal. It's just, but the deal is, I was 100% hopeless of my situation ever improving, of me ever being able to live life in any kind of reasonable way, drinking or not drinking. And I tell you what, another thing was, it was an awful, awful lonely feeling. And when I got to the rooms, they told me I'd never have to feel the way I felt when I got here. And I didn't believe that at first, but I believe it now. And thank God for that. Thank God for that. So I spent about 3 days in this mindset. I'm dead. I'm in hell. They let me back into the regular drunk tank and got in some fights. But after several days of this, I finally got a little light bulb in my head. You know, maybe these guys were just messing with me. You know, but I knew that if I wasn't dead, I must be dying because my whole body hurt. I couldn't eat. I felt like I'd been run over by like 100 mules or something, you know, just kicked the shit out of me or something, you know. I don't know if any of y'all got experience with the crappie flop, but it really messed me up. And I never want to get sober again, ever. So I realized maybe they're just messing with me. So I started begging for help. I started begging them, you know, let me see a doctor. Let me go to the hospital. Something. Give me some kind of help, you know. Finally, they let me go like an hour before I was going to go up for plea and arraignment, and they were going to keep me with no bail for a long, long time. I'd probably have died, but they let me go with my mom and dad. They'd been trying to get me out, because they knew how sick I was, under the condition that I would go directly to detox. And I was like, wherever, just get me some help. I didn't find this out too much later, but they told my dad, if he gets out of the Jeep to even smoke a cigarette, you call us and we'll have every cop in Saline County on his ass. Okay, and that's my relationship with them. They told my parents that I was a menace to myself and a menace to society, you know, and I was going to run. But I was through, all right? And I got to detox, the sobering center in Little Rock. Thank God for that place. And I went to sleep, and I woke up, and this woman, you know, it's kind of like, a lot of y'all probably been there, but a lot of y'all probably haven't, but it was kind of like set up, you got all these beds. Well, even if you've never been, like, in there for your drinking, you maybe carried the message in there, okay? All right. But you got a bed, and you got this little curtain you can pull around, and I had my curtain pulled around me, and I hear this woman's voice, Daniel. And they've got a lamp on the other side of this curtain. I wake up, and there's all this bright white light all around me. I'm like, oh, holy shit, you know. I have a strong religious background, okay. I'm not religious today, but I grew up in the Catholic Church and going to the Missionary Baptist Church every Sunday. That's a whole nother story. But I knew some things about heaven, hell, and purgatory. And I was thinking, man, maybe I'm in purgatory, you know? That'd be like sweet, because you can get out of that shit, you know? She said, "You need anything, Daniel?" And I was like, man, you know, it took me like 2 or 3 minutes to answer her, because I was thinking, what do you say, you know? What? And I thought, maybe they let you smoke in purgatory. And I said, a cigarette maybe would be nice. And she said, well, okay, you need to get your ass in that room next door. There's fixing to be an AA meeting. I said, yes, ma'am, I'm there. All right. And that's how I went to my first AA meeting. I'd never been before. Didn't know what AA was. I went into this room, and there was 3 members of Alcoholics Anonymous carried a meeting in there. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. I hope I never do. But these guys, and from what I understand, they're all 3 still sober this day, but they carried the message to me, okay? And this is how I was. All right, I had turned into a nasty drunk, okay? That's all there is to say. That when they weighed me in, I weighed 138 pounds. I had sea tick bites from head to toe from being hogtied on a gravel road in August in Arkansas. I had cuts all over my face and upper body from fighting in jail. I probably hadn't bathed in a couple weeks. These people from Alcoholics Anonymous shook my hand and told me they was glad I was there, all right? And that's, you know, it'd been a long time since anybody shook my hand, you know, and told me that I was glad I was there. But so they carried the message. They talked about themselves and what they used to be like and how they used to think and how they used to try to get to that perfect level and they couldn't, and they'd go right past it. And then they shared about getting sober and working these 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And there was just something about it that I'll never forget, that these people, I just knew there was something real about them. Because who in their right mind would take time out of their busy schedule to come see a sick, nasty drunk like me and try to help me? And I knew there was something real here, and I didn't know what it was, but it gave me just enough hope that maybe if I do what these people did, I won't want to die, you know? Maybe if it really works like they say it does, I can have a life that's worth living. That's all I was after, you know? And so that's what I did. I got from there. I went to a treatment center. I went to Serenity Park. Thank God for that place, you know? We got some alumnus up in here, you know? I got down this real quick. Spilled a little. I've always been a messy drunk. But anyways, I started working the steps. The first step, all I'm going to say is, it was a relief to finally find out what my problem is. My problem is, I'm just like all these people in AA. I have an allergy to alcohol. When I put one in me, I develop a phenomenon of craving. And when I'm not drinking, I'm obsessing about getting that sense of ease and comfort. So I'm screwed because my brain's telling my body can do something it physically cannot do. And that's a recipe for death and permanent insanity, you know. And I was a firm believer because I experienced that firsthand. You know, I drank to the gates of insanity or death, and I was only 19 at the time, you know. But it was such a relief, you know. And then I found out, you know, that my real problem's in my mind because my body's never going to change. So I got to work these steps so that I never get so screwed up in the head that I think I have to take a drink to fix it. And the third step, I had this experience in the shower one morning. I shared about it last night, but I was like so scared of all this God stuff. Like the last prayer I'd said before the third step prayer was, God, let me die or give me some kind of help. And I ended up in hell. All right. So I was scared to death of praying the third step prayer because I had seen in my childhood what happened when people get God in church and stuff. And that was not attractive to me at that time, all right? I was 19, I was a heathen. And, you know, I was like, I wasn't all about going and building huts in Ethiopia and handing out Bibles at the airport. But just like I share, that's not. But I had I reached a turning point. Okay, just like it says in How It Works, we reached a turning point. My turning point was in the shower one morning. I realized that I will do anything not to go back where I just came from. Anything. I'll stand on my head on top of the Washington Monument with people planting bombs in it. Who cares? You know, whatever I got to do to get this, you know, whatever these people tell me to do, I will do it. You know, if I have to go build the huts, but whatever. And I made that decision that morning in the shower to go on with the steps. And today, of course, I understand that step a little differently. I'm turning it over to the care of God, as I understand him. Because my will, my life, my thinking and my actions when I got here was all kinds of messed up. I needed a new set of directions because my directions were just messed up. And my new set of directions was the steps. So I got working on the steps. And the fourth and fifth step, all right, when they explained to me, here's what you do. You take these sheets of paper. You start out with the first column of the resentments. You write down everybody you're mad at or every institution. And I was talking to my first sponsor about this, and I was like, man, this is going to be so easy. And I pulled this list out of my wallet. I had made it at some time the last few weeks or months of my drinking, a list of everybody that had to die before I did. And this is actually something that kept me alive one day, all right? Because there was one day I really was going to blow my brains out, but two things stopped me. One was all the people that had to die before I did. And two was it was about harvest time, and I had some pot growing. All right. So, and by the way, I got sober. I didn't get to smoke any of that stuff. My buddy got it off. And thank God he got it in time before I had to go to prison for it because they knew about it. Long story. Anyways, let's get off of that. But I made my inventory, my first one. All right. Let me explain another thing about the burnt deal. All right. When they took me to detox, my parents, and I hadn't drank or drugged in 5 days. Okay, I love newcomers because I love talking to them, seeing where they're at mentally, like if they're even there with us, because I wasn't, all right? And they say that, you know, about 5% of what I told them made sense. I couldn't talk and make sense. So when I did my first fourth and fifth step, I did the best I could because I did not want to go back where I just came from. And it worked. All right. If I looked at it today, I'd probably be like, this is the biggest piece of crap you've ever seen. But it was the best I could do, and it worked. It kept me sober. And I did the fifth step with my sponsor, you know. And then later in sobriety, some things happened where I had to get another sponsor, and I got the chance to do it again. And I did it, man. You talk about, like, thorough and, like, I got to get it all out. And thank God for that. He had a plan to help me out with that. But anyways, these resentments, I had such deep-seated resentments. And there were a few of them that were so hardcore that just doing the fifth step didn't just make them just go away like a lot of them. And so I had to pray for some people. And I had to actually want to be free of the resentment before I could ever be willing to look at my part, you know. However insignificant my part seemed, I mean, that's the only way I can get freedom. And so I eventually developed that willingness on those few resentments I had that were real deep-seated. And then the fear, man, that's something that I still experience today. I mean, I still experience all this today, you know, but not near like it was. But and the sex, okay? Amanda made me promise not to talk about the farm animals. But I'm not going to say it. But here's the deal about the sexual inventory. Thank God they wrote about sex in a spiritual book in the 30s. I think that took some guts. But I don't know that I'd be sober without it. All right? There were some things I had a lot of embarrassment and shame and remorse about in that area and other areas that I was never going to tell anybody. I was going to take them to my grave. And I told my sponsor these things. And then he turned around and said, man, that's, you know, you're pretty sick, yeah. But, you know, I did some sick stuff like that, like this right here, you know, and he told me about it. And I was like, man, you know, that wasn't so bad. And now, and what I gained from that fifth step experience was another human being in my life that knows everything there is to know about me, all the horrible stuff I was going to take to my grave, and I can trust this person. First person I ever felt I could completely trust. And you talk about some loneliness going away, all right? The fifth step promises. You know, a lot of people I've heard share around where I go to AA talk. They talk about when they did the fifth step, they felt like 250-pound feed sacks been lifted off their shoulders. You know, and I didn't really get that. You know, but I got what it said in the book. I got this stuff where it was like for the first time I felt like, man, maybe this will work. You know, I got this feeling that maybe there is a God that's going to help me. You know, and then I realized, man, I can look at people in the eye over the next few weeks. And I was like, man, you know, I can actually sleep at night without thinking about it. So anyways, step 6 and 7, let's see how we're doing on time. Oh, yeah, we still got about 2.5 hours. We're good. But anyways, step 7, I'm not going to talk about ochre or nothing. I got here for the end of Larry's talk, and that was, he said it much simpler and better than I could ever say it, that, you know, I've got to become willing through the fifth step, seeing how bad my character defects have screwed up my life. And then I become humble because I realize that I cannot change myself. Self cannot overcome self. You know, I have to have a power greater than myself. And I say that seven-step prayer, and then I get up and I try to act like that God's removed them. You know, and I try to practice the opposite things from my defects of character. So anyways, and the 8 and 9, you know, I don't have any, well, I have some cool men stories. I don't have time to tell them all, but, you know, I've done this step, and there's still a few that I have to do, but I would say this about 8 and 9, two different things. In 2004, I attended 7 funerals, okay, and I got married to a beautiful woman sitting right here. All right. But let me just say, all right, seven different funerals. Family members, old drinking buddies, people I got sober with, best friends in the program, got married. All right. In the year of 2004, I believe that I ran into and met with every person I've ever known. You know, it was like every family member, every old drinking buddy that's still alive or not locked up, all my new friends, all, you know, everybody. And I did not have to hide one time. All right. I could look every one of them in the eye. And that's another huge thing for me. You know, and that's because I've cleaned up the wreckage of my past as best I can. You know, my sponsor told me to pray for the willingness and opportunity to make those amends. And that's what I did. And when the opportunity came, the willingness was there. And, you know, and the law, okay, I was not on good terms with the law, like I said. And they really, really didn't like me. And I didn't give them any reasons to like me. But here's how it was. Like, they would see me out in public and lock me up there at the end of my drinking because they knew I was doing something illegal. And, anyways, but today, all right, I've got this little construction business. I built houses for, like, sergeants on the Saline County Sheriff's Department and lieutenants. You know, I mean, this is weird, okay? I remember being, like, 3 or 4 years sober building these houses for these guys, and we did this addition for this guy that locked me up one time, and I'm thinking, man, this is just too weird, all right? And then, you know, I found myself sitting in the sheriff of Saline County's house one day, just me and him. This was about a year ago, talking about building onto his house. And I was just sitting there freaking out. He's like, you want some coffee or a Coke or a cold beer or something? I was like, man, you know, and, I was like, some water, you know, give me some water, you know. And he was going to get some water, and I was just sitting there freaking out thinking, you know, here I am in the sheriff of Saline County's house with him alone, and he don't have a gun on me, you know, and that's, you know, that's part of that amends process. I become a more respectable member of society. So anyways, you know, step 10 keeps me in check, you know. Step 11, conscious contact. I got to talk about this. Uh-oh, the hamster or whatever the hell it is. Are you falling asleep, buddy? He's falling asleep. Okay, I'll prop you up here. I'm talking to you. But, all right, conscious contact. Me and a sponsee I had one time, and he's in the rooms, thank God, today. We were talking about the 11th step, and I had a lot of problems with that step when I was getting sober and working the steps. And he was like, you know, what is conscious contact? I was like, man, I think I know what it is, but let's go ahead and look that up in the dictionary. And it said to be preoccupied with, conscious means to be preoccupied with or to have an awareness of. And I was like, man, that like simplifies it so much it ain't even funny, because it's asking me to seek through prayer and meditation to be preoccupied with my higher power, to be aware of the gifts my higher power has given me. And that's so much simpler. You know, I remember, and there may be a few of the people that participate in this in this room, but, you know, I'll talk about this in meetings sometime. But, I mean, I got kind of out there in the spiritual meditation field in early sobriety, you know. I'm not going to go into all that, but I ain't got the time. But anyways, the 12th step. All right, the 11th step, I pray for God's will and the power to carry it out. Knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And my sponsor has told me that the simplest answer to what is God's will for me is the 12th step. All right, I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and I continue to have that. And when I begin to practice these principles in all my affairs and work with other alcoholics, I'm doing God's will. And it's that simple. And I don't have to get all screwed up in the head about these decisions like, should I go to school? Should I go to work? Should I go, you know, should I live here? Should I live there? You know, and I've been told, you know, that God's more interested in what am I doing right here in this moment? You know, they read in How It Works, God, there's one that has all power. That one is God. May you find Him now. And my sponsor always stresses to me, that means right now, you know, right now in this moment, that's where God is. So anyways, I got to talk about this circle and triangle we got on all our stuff. How much time I got? About 5 hours left? Okay. No, it ain't that bad, really. But the circle and triangle we got here in AA, and the three sides of the triangle are recovery, unity, and service. And I frame houses for a living. We always frame the roof in the shape of a triangle because it's the most structurally sound structure. Like, if you look at this roof, there's triangles everywhere. You know, these trusses got triangles in them. The roof's a triangle. You take one side of that triangle out, and the whole thing falls down. And that's how my sobriety is. I have got to have recovery through working the steps of my sponsor. I've got to have the unity of being actively involved in a home group. I've got to have the service through actively being involved in general AA service work. And those three things are extremely important to me. You know, like I said, I have a huge debt to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people that came and cared for me when I was nasty, you know, and that's why I take it serious, you know. And so this convention, I've got to talk about this a little bit. You know, I had the privilege of going through the Archipel Committee. And, man, let me just say that God, of my understanding, gives me opportunities to be of service at all times through the day. He gives me opportunities to have service commitments. You know, when I walk in and take the action and follow through on these opportunities, I get blessed big time, right? What I mean by that is, you know, as a result of service, as a result of whatever, you know, that's how I met my wife, who's been on this committee. That's how I met, like, a lot of good friends. You know, there's people in other states that would allow me into their home. You know, I didn't have that kind of stuff when I got here. You know, anyways, I could go on and on about that. But service commitments were real important to me. This year, the 1st of January, I rotated out as alternate DCM of District 8, and I didn't get elected to DCM, and I wasn't upset about that at all because that meant I got to come to Arkansas instead of the Sforza or whatever. But, okay. But, but anyways, I found myself without a serious AA commitment, okay, service commitment. And, you know, I was still carrying message places, treatment center, prison down in Malvern, but it just freaks me out not to have, because, I mean, I started out as chip boy, and my home group, and there's some people here that could tell you, they would not let me give that job up for 2 years. By God, you're going to do 2 years, you know. And I was like, well, look at this guy. He's a newcomer. He needs, you know, no, we have commitments. And so anyways, a group of the young people here in Central Arkansas got together and started talking about forming an IKIPAW big committee. And I was like, hell yay, I'll do it. And we had our elections. They elected me chairman. So so now I got a commitment, you know, and it's like, and it's just awesome. But I got to talk just a little bit about young people stuff, okay? And I was meditating earlier today, and I was trying to think of what was the first young people stuff I went to. All right, when I got out of treatment, I went to a halfway house in Opelousas, Louisiana.
What?
All right. I'll drink to that. Okay. Just outside Lafayette. All right. But anyway, the first young people stuff I remember going to, Friday nights, and man, I look forward to going to this, was, what was the name of the group? Some of y'all remember it.
Simply Sober
at the Camel House, all right? And I'd go up in there and see young people having fun, and it blew my mind because I thought that I was a freak of nature for being sober at my age, and that sobriety was going to be like, go to work, go to a meeting, go home and lock the doors and hire a guard. But it ain't nothing like that. But then I got back to Arkansas, and I went to meetings, and there was a guy named Estes that everybody's talked about, and his son, Daniel, and Bart C., and a few other people that I would go to these meetings in Little Rock. And they would say, you know, and Estes had a real nice way of saying it, but he'd say, you need to get your state funded crackhead ass down to the next Arkansas business meeting. I'd be like, okay, man. And, so that's how I got involved in Arkansas, you know, and they drew me in, okay? And another thing I got to say about young people's stuff, IKIPAW, Arkansas, all this stuff. The facts, aims, and purposes of IKIPAW, I don't know if it still says this, but it used to. It said that the purpose is to carry young people into the mainstream of Alcoholics Anonymous through service. That is the purpose. You know, not so we can get wild and tear up stuff and, you know, vandalize hotels. You know, it's
steel banners.
God. But anyway, all right, let's not get into that. That's an issue. That is an issue, and it's somewhere outside. But that's the purpose of all this. You know, it's for these people to get involved, and that's what my story is. I got involved on Arkansas, you know, and then after being chip boy for 2 years, they actually trusted me to be alternate GSR, and then I was GSR, then alternate DCM. You know, so that's what it did for me. You know, and you know, anyways, that's all I'm going to say. But there were these young people, and there weren't near as many as there are now in Central Arkansas, but these people made it fun, you know. They made it cool to be sober young. You know, like we went swimming into blue holes. Maybe or maybe we didn't have our clothes on, but we went, you know, I mean, we did a lot of fun stuff. And it was like all these people like Estes, man, I mean, everybody remembers him, and he made it fun, you know. All the people, Daniel and had a lot of fun with these people. They made it fun for me, you know, and that's why, like, now people say, you know, I get real alcoholic with the fires and stuff like that. But, like, man, that's what it's all about, just so we can have fun. I mean, I was standing out there smoking right when the Mardi Gras started. I mean, that just chokes me up every year to see a bunch of drunks having so much fun, you know, and we ain't got to be messed up to do it. And it's like we're in the moment, you know, we're right here in this moment, we're having fun. And so that's what I try to do, you know. And here's another thing about fun, okay. When I was drinking, my belief was I had to drink to have fun, to be happy. All right. Now it's completely opposite. I work the steps. As a byproduct of right living, I get happiness. As a result of that, I can have fun no matter what I'm doing. And let me tell you something. You can have fun no matter what you're doing. We have a lot of fun at work now. I mean, there's some alcoholics that work with me, and some cousins and some that probably need to be with us. But we have all kinds of fun messing with each other. Let me tell you one thing. I got to skip back to something. Man, being like this full circle deal, okay? Like I was sharing about what we're going to talk about, okay? But like when you're sharing your fifth step with your sponsor about all these things that you are horribly ashamed of, and they share with you, and you find out, man, I'm really not that bad. I'm just a sick person, and I can get better. And then you sponsor somebody, and they have a hard time, and maybe they've left something out, and you go like, well, are there any farm animal stories or anything? And like here's like my most ashamed thing I've ever done. And they're like, whoa, man, I wasn't going to tell you, but look, I did some of this, you know. And then you're like, and then it's like where your most sick, most things I was most ashamed of helped somebody a lot, you know. And, man, some of them are just downright hilarious. I did a fifth step with a guy. God bless him. I laughed my ass off for 4 or 5 hours. And I begged him for a year to tell people about some of these things in his fifth step because it was just so funny. I just could not hold it. I mean, I was like, I'm dying here, man. You know, other people need to know. You need to write stories about this or something. Like, I mean, this was some really sick stuff, but it's hilarious. But now he's sponsoring people, you know, and he's telling them that stuff, and they get to hear it and laugh about it and tell them his stuff. You know, it's like, it's just a never-ending chain, you know, and that's awesome. But anyways, I guess I got to start wrapping it up here. What is it like now? All right. What it's like for me now? I do the same things to stay sober now as I did my first 9 days of sobriety, okay? The 10th step is very simple and clear. When, not if. Resentment, self-pity, selfishness, dishonesty pop up. When these pop up, I got 4 things to do. Talk it over with my sponsor immediately. Make amends to somebody if I owe them an amends. Ask God to remove it and turn my thoughts to someone else I can help. That's simple. You know, that's not rocket science. And then, you know, the 11th step, continuing to seek that awareness of God. And then the 12th step, practicing the principles. I mean, these are simple things, you know, and there is no advanced AA. I love, there's a guy, used to go to Last Chance meeting, that he would share, you know, he hears people say, you know, I got to get back to basics. You know, I'm getting in a funk. I need to get back to the basics. And he's like, does that mean that there's like an advanced AA course? Like you go like from basic to intermediate to advanced, you know. But there ain't. You know, all we have is basics. All we have is the first 164 pages in the doctor's opinion. Everything I need to know about how to live a sober life is in there. So, to the newcomers, I would like to say, do not quit before the miracle happens. Expect a miracle. You know, if it can happen for me, it can happen for you. And we share our experience, strength, and hope. My hope is the growth and maintenance of a spiritual experience. Okay? But beyond that, my hope is to go on like some very dear friends of mine that are now in a big meeting in the sky and graduate successfully. You know, that's my hope. There's a guy, Mike Seaman, died last year and was a very close friend of mine, worked for me, was in my home group, and he got cancer and died a month later and knew he was dying. And I'll never forget, you know, if you'd have told him there's 12 simple steps you got to do and you won't have cancer, he'd have done it. Lucky he split, you know. And but he went on, and I mean, he was calmer than his family through all of it, you know. And I mean, it just amazed me, you know. These are my heroes, people like him, people like Estes, people like, you know, all the old timers that have gone on. And you know, but it's not just them, it's the new people coming in behind us. You know, it's getting to see the lights come on. You know, that's my hope, is to stick around and see that happen some more, to see people come alive. You know, this is where dead people come to life, okay? That's what happened for me. And it is the joy of my life to get to see that happen. You know, next year I hope everybody comes back and bring a newcomer. You know, everybody needs to stick around for some Jenga. I'm talking about, you know, I have fun. I mean, like what I'm saying, because I'm happy on the inside, man. At Lacey Paul this year, I got to share this. I have got to share this. All right, some of y'all are not experienced with Jenga. Some people say some of that young people's crap that doesn't need to happen. But there's this one guy, I forget his name. I ain't going to say his name because that wouldn't be right, but he knocked it over. I had to give him a lick. And I've never seen the pre-smack jitters as bad as I'm talking about. Dude just bent over, oh, do it, get it over with, you know. And I was laughing so hard I about couldn't hit it. And then he turned around, knocked it over again, and went through the same thing again. And I mean, there's like such joy in my heart. It just don't get any better than this. I mean, this is a life I've always dreamed of. You know, I mean, like, how can you have more fun? So anyways, y'all need to stick around for that. We're going to have another fire and all that, you know. But I'm gonna go ahead and close with a little story that won't take 2 seconds. But there was one of these guys that I talked about going on to the big meeting in the sky. His name was Asel. And there's a few people from Benton here probably remember him. But he was this short old man when I got sober, and he was one of these old guys that had this deal and lived a spiritual life, and he'd run up to you when you come through the door and give you a big hug and say, man, I'm glad you're here. And when he first did that, I was like, man, what, whoa, you know, I didn't come here for all that. But anyways, I was about a year and a half sober or something like that. All my buddies were going to prison and dying. I'm in here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've worked the steps. My life has gotten so much better. I'm trying to work with sponsees, but nothing seems to be working. They're still going back out. And I just shared in this meeting, you know, what the hell? You know, why am I here? Why did I get to get sober and everybody else is dying? You know, what? I can't even help these people, you know, which I understand now is just an ego issue. But anyways, I was really frustrated, really wondering what my real purpose here is. And he pulled me aside after the meeting. He said, Daniel, you are here because God has a plan and a purpose for your life. So make it count. And that's all I got. Thank you.